don't know whether I ever expected to experience.
Those are just some of the highlights from the first 25 years of Democracy Now!, kicking off our 25th anniversary year. We will be playing excerpts and posting on social media and our website, democracynow.org, many of the programs we want to highlight. We want to thank the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have helped us over these 25 years. What an honor it has been to work with all of you. With my colleague Juan Gonzalez and Nermeen Sheikh, we thank all of you for being with us for 25 years. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask. Where to? Stay safe. Thank you so much.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a development director. Our development director oversees KBOO's fundraising, donor and business outreach, and leads the development team with light supervisory duties. Our ideal candidate has at least 4 years of proven development experience in the nonprofit sector, preferably with significant foundation and major donor fundraising work. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Apply by February 24th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, former Senator Margaret Carter encourages the Black community to get vaccinated. The Oregon Landlord Compensation Fund has begun accepting applications. And in national news, the Biden administration unveiled an ambitious immigration bill. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 19th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. Democrats in the Oregon legislature have introduced a bill to close a loophole in existing federal gun control laws. Representatives Lisa Reynolds and Janine Solomon have sponsored House Bill 2543 to ban the sale of firearms in Oregon without a successful background check. The federal law currently states that if a background check is not completed within 3 days, a gun dealer can sell the gun without a completed check. The gap in federal law has been called the Charleston loophole because it allowed the perpetrator of the 2015 massacre at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in South Carolina to purchase a gun. The shooter was prohibited from buying a gun, but was able to buy one because his background check was not completed in time. Proponents of the bill say it's another necessary step to reduce gun violence, while opponents predictably call the bill an infringement on Second Amendment rights. As of yesterday morning, more than 250 individuals and organizations had submitted testimony both for and against the bill. And one of the strongest responses came from within the party of the bill's sponsors. The Democratic Party of Oregon Gun Owners Caucus wrote that the bill opens the door to a, quote, de facto ban on firearms purchases. But Representative Solomon said her office collected data indicating reporting that as many as 2,200 checks may have been missed in Oregon over the last 2.5 years. Governor Kate Brown held a press conference this morning to update Oregonians on the state's ongoing response to the COVID pandemic. She started out by addressing the challenges associated with the winter storm and power failures.
I wanted to start this morning by addressing the severe winter weather of the past week, which left hundreds of thousands of Oregonians without power across the Willamette Valley. Utilities in our region have experienced severe, widespread outages. 1 week in, more than 70,000 Oregonians remain without power. I know this has been really, really difficult. And I also know that on top of the ongoing pandemic, many Oregonians faced a difficult choice, warmth or safety. To choose the warmth of staying with friends or family in a powered home, or to remain home without heat and light, but safer from gathering indoors with people outside your household. We all do the best we can for our families during these tough circumstances. If you did shelter with family or friends and experience COVID in the coming days, please test and isolate until you know you're healthy.
Brown then congratulated Oregonians for continuing to have one of the lowest infection rates in the country. She said that the decline in case rates, hospitalizations, and death rates would allow more schools to reopen in the coming weeks. Before turning the press conference over to state health officials, she introduced Senator Margaret Carter.
Many of you know Senator Margaret Carter, the first Black woman elected to the Oregon legislature. She's 85 years young and was thrilled to receive her first vaccine shot earlier today. I asked her to share a few words about her experience.
Hi, I'm Abby from OHSU. We're super excited to have former State Senator Margaret Carter here, an amazing community leader. And are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do it.
You know, Abby, one of the reasons I'm so ready is because I want our community to know I am taking this shot and it's safe. And even though we have a history of government intervention, because we go back to the Tuskegee days, but I want our community to know that this is safe, and I want you to join me in taking this shot.
Studies have indicated that the death rate from COVID among Indigenous people, Black people, and Pacific Islanders can be as much as 2 times greater than that for whites. But despite the higher mortality rates, many in the BIPOC community are skeptical of vaccines due to historical and systemic mistreatment. Senator Carter's comments were clearly intended to send a message that the vaccinations are safe and necessary to protect themselves and their loved ones. On Wednesday, the Oregon Landlord Compensation Fund began accepting applications. The $150 million fund was established as part of House Bill 4401 in the third special legislative session of 2020. The money is available for landlords who file declarations of financial hardship as a result of Oregon's ongoing eviction moratorium. As much as $50 million per month will be paid out by the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency, and the payments will continue until June or the money runs out, whichever comes first. If requests total less than $50 million per month, all requests will be honored. But if applications exceed the $50 million threshold, the legislation requires a competitive application process to determine recipients. Natasha Detweiler-Darby is the Assistant Director of Planning and Policy. She says the idea is to, quote, prioritize payments to projects that are from small portfolio owners as well as those with the highest percentage of unpaid rent. Commercial property owners are not eligible. As part of the deal, landlords will receive compensation for 80% of back rent as long as they're willing to forgive the remaining 20%. The fund is available to cover uncollected rent between April 2020 and the present, but does not cover utilities or other unpaid fees. The landlord fund is separate from the $50 million tenant fund that the legislature also established. Landlords are invited to apply for the Oregon Landlord Compensation Fund online between now and March 2nd. Tenants are urged to call 211 to connect to social services. As of this morning, Portland General Electric was still reporting about 80,000 customers without power. They hope to have 65,000 of them back online by the end of the day. According to PGE spokesperson Quentin Gaddis, the company has, quote, restored 300 miles of transmission lines and 226 distribution lines, which involve over 40 miles of power lines. By the end of the day, they will have restored power to over 600,000 customers since last weekend's ice storm. But the company is unsure how long the last 15,000 will remain in the dark, and those customers are growing frustrated as they enter their second weekend without power. PGE President Maria Pope promised that the company would work through the weekend to get the job done. She said, quote, "We will continue working 24/7 all through the weekend and into next week to ensure that those customers get their power on as quickly as possible. And we will have more information as we continue to discover the extent of the damage." Clackamas County has begun operating storm resource centers for those who have been impacted by the winter storm and power outages. The resources will have water, blankets, flashlights, batteries, and additional supplies for community members. The centers will also have showers and charging stations and food boxes while supplies last. The centers will be open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and are located at the County Fairgrounds in Canby, the Church of the Nazarene in Molalla, and Oregon City High School. If you or a neighbor needs help, you can call 503-655-8224 or send an email to www.clackamas.us/contact-us. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next, at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, stick around for The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. We can expect a cloudy evening, giving way to rain overnight. Temperatures will drop into the low 40s. Tomorrow, we'll see a cloudy day mixed with periods of rain and a high near 50. On this day in 1950, ground was broken for Mississippi Vocational College, later renamed Mississippi Valley State University. It is the youngest of 106 historically black colleges and universities in the United States. Today's quote is from the late Chadwick Boseman, a graduate of Howard University. In his commencement address to the class of 2018, he said, quote, "Howard's legacy is not wrapped up in the money that you'll make, but the challenges that you choose to confront. As you commence on your paths, press on with pride and press on with purpose." An unprecedented wave of anti-protest legislation is sweeping across the country. The bills cover a wide range of actions, including steeper penalties for disrupting government activities, blocking traffic, and destruction of property. Yesterday, the Civil Liberties Defense Center hosted a public webinar outlining this new wave of dissent-silencing legislation and how to resist it. KBOO's Isabel Charlet has more.
I spoke with Stephanie Tidwell, Deputy Director of the Eugene-based Civil Liberties Defense Center and the facilitator of yesterday's webinar panel discussion. By Tidwell's count, there are currently 59 anti-protest bills in more than 20 states making their way through state legislatures. These bills target a wide range of activities related to expressing dissent that civil liberties advocates are saying are a direct response to the Black Lives Matter and climate justice movements.
More than half a dozen specifically target pipeline protests during critical infrastructure. Other ones are clearly designed to suppress racial justice protests.
In Washington State, Republican State Senator Jeff Holy has proposed a bill that would increase penalties for violence during a protest, such as a minimum 6-month prison sentence for assaulting a police officer. Another bill in Washington State, proposed by Senator McCune, is a prohibition against the act of intentionally blocking traffic and could give immunity for hitting protesters with cars. Under new penalties proposed in Nebraska, Mississippi, and Indiana, you could be charged with a felony simply for being at a protest where injuries or significant property damage took place, even if you personally were not involved. The justification from the proponents of these bills is that they are a response to the deadly attacks on the state capitol on January 6th. However, as Tidwell points out, many of these bills were already being written before January and are unlikely to target far-right or white supremacist groups.
To the best of my knowledge, none of them specifically target the far-right. What they do is challenge protests generally. But when you look at the language and who's actually doing these types of protests, it's not going to be the far-right that will be impacted by them.
Half a dozen of these bills specifically focus on activists who may aid the disruption of fossil fuel infrastructure. For example, one bill coming out of Minnesota calls for up to 10 years in prison for anyone who aids someone who targets an oil or gas pipeline. A number of bills in this new wave specifically target the movements for Palestinian rights by seeking to restrict boycotts of Israel. Tidwell says these types of attempts are not new to Palestinian rights advocates. According to the ACLU, more than 24 states have adopted laws and policies restricting boycotts of Israel in the past 4 years. This kind of response to mass protest is not new. The U.S. saw a similar wave of bills after the 2017 protests against the election of Donald Trump and a burgeoning white supremacist movement. Tidwell says a crucial difference between this moment and similar surges of anti-protest bills is the speed at which they are being introduced and pushed through the legislative process. Another complicating factor is the coronavirus, which makes having public testimony more challenging.
Most legislatures are not having open testimony, and there is less of an opportunity for the public to engage in this whole process.
In many parts of the country, this new wave of legislation is facing a large backlash in court and on the streets already, and most bills are likely to be found unconstitutional. However, Tidwell stresses the importance of anyone who supports social change to be closely following this trend.
They really don't have a constitutional right to stand on. But what we look at when we see these is yet another attempt by far-right extremists to silence progressive voices for change. And it's important for these progressive voices to recognize that and to not let these right-wing fear movements suppress those voices.
For KBOO News, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Yesterday, the Biden administration and congressional Democrats introduced a comprehensive immigration bill that would provide a path to citizenship for undocumented people within 8 years. If passed, the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021 would be the first major immigration legislation since 2013. The bill includes an 8-year pathway to citizenship for nearly 11 million undocumented immigrants. It would also provide a shorter process to legal status for agriculture workers or recipients of DACA. The bill also includes an enforcement plan that would deploy technology to patrol the border, as the Biden administration redirected the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency to prioritize national security threats. And in national politics, former Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele predicted that Republicans will lose Texas in 2024. With more on those stories and others, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're tracking our democracy in historic times.
We understand that immigration reform isn't just a collection of policies or debates in Washington. It could mean the full realization of the American dream for millions of families in every community in this country.
Democratic Representative Linda Sanchez of California is one of the lead sponsors of a wide-ranging immigration bill introduced yesterday in the House and Senate. The U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021 would provide a path to citizenship for nearly all the 11 million immigrants here without authorization and would allow more legal immigration. At a virtual news conference, Democratic Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey said the bill would help address the causes of migration: crime, violence, corruption, and poverty.
Beyond enhancing security and improving management of the southern border, our legislation also finally addresses the push factors forcing so many families to flee Central America.
The bill would invest $4 billion in the economies of Central America. While Democrats have thin majorities in both houses, it would need the support of 10 Republican senators to avoid a Senate filibuster. For its part, the Biden administration is directing Immigration and Customs Enforcement to focus more on migrants who may pose a national security threat. President Biden also declared an emergency in Louisiana yesterday after emergency declarations for Texas and Oklahoma. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas returned early from a trip to Cancun as criticism mounted he'd left as winter storms continued to crush Texas. According to Michael Steele, former chair of the Republican National Committee, politics in the Lone Star State is shifting.
Here's my prediction. Texas will be a battleground state in 2024. And my prediction is Republicans lose Texas in 2024.
Steele told a virtual panel hosted by the Brennan Center for Justice and the New York Public Library that Congress was right to impeach Donald Trump a second time.
I didn't like the outcome, but I appreciated and was grateful for the process, even though 43 members of my party thought and felt otherwise. What it did show was that this democracy is worth fighting for.
Joining similar moves in other states, yesterday Maine's Republican leadership condemned Senator Susan Collins for her vote to convict Trump. Also yesterday, Vice President Kamala Harris talked about the 2.5 million women who have left the workforce since the pandemic began.
Women leaving the workforce in these numbers, it's a national emergency, and it demands a national solution.
During a virtual roundtable with members of Congress and advocates, Harris urged Congress to pass COVID relief to support women and children. In other items, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster signed a bill yesterday banning most abortions in the state. And Secretary of State Tony Blinken told his EU counterparts that the U.S. is ready to open talks with Iran. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
In Montana, the tribal police force for the Fort Belknap Indian community has joined the Criminal Justice Information Network, a national database tracking missing persons. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Montana Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force announced the Fort Belknap Indian community became the last tribal police force in the state to join a national network of criminal justice databases. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports.
The police of the Nakota and Ani Nations are the newest law enforcement team in Montana to join the Criminal Justice Information Network, also known as CJIN. Brian Frost, missing persons specialist for the task force, says CJIN is basically a law enforcement pipeline connecting criminal justice databases from the state, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and other federal and state agencies.
So when they want sensitive criminal justice law enforcement information or when they have an active missing persons case, they used to call Blaine County and ask Blaine County to perform those transactions for them. Now Fort Belknap will be able to do that on their own, and they won't have a third party. So that's fantastic news.
The task force also reports missing persons cases are down nearly 10% since January, after many people were found alive and well. There are 167 active missing persons cases in Montana. Nearly 32% of those missing are Indigenous. Only about 7% of Montanans are Native American. For National Native News and Report for America, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
U.S. lawmakers Wednesday speaking to members of the Native American Contractors Association during the group's annual two-day conference held virtually, pledged to work with Indian Country on economic prosperity, COVID-19 relief, and business development. Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii says he looks forward to working with tribes in his new role as chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. He says the next COVID-19 relief package has big investments for tribes and says there's likely bipartisan support in areas of tribal business and contracting.
I'm hoping that this can be a sort of relaunch of our partnership over the long run. And I'm very much looking forward to what is to come.
Congressman Don Young of Alaska discussed his role as a ranking member on the House Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples.
And we're going to continue to work together to try to make sure that my Alaska Natives primarily, I have to be very frank with you, and American Indians of Lower 48 can continue to go forth and be successful.
Congresswoman Deb Haaland, who's Biden's nominee for Secretary of the Interior, in a three-minute pre-recorded message, spoke about tribal economic and business initiatives, government-to-government relationships, and trust responsibilities. Thursday's agenda includes remarks from U.S. lawmakers from Montana, Nevada, Maine, and Illinois, as the Native organization sets priorities for the year and develops plans to work with the Biden administration. A federal judge temporarily stopped the sale of a National Archives building in Seattle, Washington. KNBA's Trip Krause has more.
In a written order filed Tuesday morning, U.S. District Court Judge John C. Kunauer ordered a halt to the imminent sale of the National Archives building and removal of an immense archival collection. In a news release, Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson said, quote, "Today's legal victory blocks the federal government's unlawful plan to sell the archives and scatter the DNA of our region thousands of miles away," end quote. In January 2020, a five-person panel identified the archives building in Seattle and 11 other facilities as excess properties and opportunities for the federal government to cut costs. The archives building houses a collection that includes historical documents and records for 272 federally recognized tribes in Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. A sale of the building could move the archives records as far away as Kansas City, Missouri, and Riverside, California. In January 2021, Washington State's Attorney General and 40 tribes, states, and community organizations filed a motion to block the sale of the building. In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
When people think of climate change, hotter and wetter weather is what most often comes to mind. But the brutal winter storm that paralyzed the Texas power grid this week is another example of global warming. For more on that, here's Roz Brown with the Public News Service.
Most extreme weather events in the U.S. have been on the hotter and wetter side in recent years, including fires and floods. But climate experts say the catastrophic winter storm in Texas is another example of global warming. Edward Maybach is the director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. He says climate change is a complicated topic and not completely understood, and that might explain why the Texas energy grid couldn't handle demand during this week's storm.
Why the public utility operators across Texas weren't expecting the possibility of a massive cold snap, they just haven't had time to recognize that as a threat.
Maybach says it's believed destabilization of the polar vortex is why we've seen such events as a heat wave in Greenland and the severe cold snap across the southern United States. Amid widespread power losses, millions of Texans have also been advised to boil their water for safety. Texas is home to much of the U.S. oil and gas industry, At the same time, the state leads the nation in wind power generation. Wind turbines that froze were blamed by Governor Greg Abbott for this week's massive power outages, although the main problem was stalled natural gas production due to frigid temperatures. The governor, a longtime backer of the fossil fuel industry, said it's an example of how bad the Green New Deal would be for the U.S. Maybach counters that blaming the crisis on clean energy is short-sighted.
The kind of political theater that we see the governor enacting at the moment, I just don't think it's going to be politically tenable in a few years, once the clean energy economy of the state is even further established.
Maybach adds he's encouraged that President Joe Biden is taking aggressive action on climate change, including rejoining the Paris Agreement and reviewing rollbacks of standards that protect air and water. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 19th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Antonia Gonzalez, Laura Rosbro-Tellum, Eric Tegedoff, Roz Brown, Isabel Charlet, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.
You're listening to Community Radio,
KBOO, Portland.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, one of the more hopeful things you might not have heard about is the revival in the House of Representatives of the Forced Arbitration Injustice Repeal, or FAIR.